Good evening. I recently heard that 1 out of 7 people in this country originated in Brooklyn. And I share this, pardon me? Right. And I share this information with you, not only so you can understand my R's, but also how you can understand and appreciate and delight in the wonderful nonverbals and verbals of our speaker, Michael Conforti, who could have only learned them on the streets of Brooklyn. In 1999, Michael Conforti delivered a series of plenary sessions to this conference, and his theme at that time was pattern recognition in psyche and matter. The excitement at the conference and the enthusiasm expressed in written responses was such that the planning committee decided to invite Michael Conforti to return to the conference this year and to present his most recent work on denial. We are delighted you accepted, Michael. Thank you. In his work on denial, Dr. Conforti has identified resistance to what Jung called objective truth in the psyche as a potent force, which opposes what Jung called the psyche's natural urge toward wholeness. Quoting Dr. Conforti, through my experience as the Jungian analyst, I have repeatedly seen how denial, while needed to some extent, also causes havoc for the individual, and equally importantly, for all those involved with the one who is in denial. Denial is a brutal process in that it demands all those around you to exercise the same level of obliteration of meaning as does the one who is in denial. That's heavy, but we'll have 4 sessions to work that out. This is especially tragic when we see how children are forced into the family's denial pattern. The children, and for that matter, friends and associates around the one in denial are often brutally demanded to accept the same singular distorted vision of the denial maker. And we've used the word brutal twice. In my talks, and this is Dr. Conforti sharing with us, in my talks I will discuss how we can come to recognize the presence and operation of these processes of denial and how they can be converted into generative, life-promoting patterns, hope. Illustrations will be taken from the clinical domain, daily life, literature, film, the new sciences, and Jungian psychology, especially Jung's notion of the shadow and evil. The plenary topics are listed, but I will repeat them for you. Tonight, we will be getting into patterns in the psyche and patterns of denial. Tomorrow is the archetype of denial. Sunday, denial as a force of life and death. And then on Monday, transforming denial in the personal and collective psyche. Welcome, Dr. Conforti.
You know, it's a woman from Brooklyn that invited me, and when she said denial, I thought you were talking about rivers. So I had all my material about Egypt. I'm sorry. It reads like a who's who's list. And I hope I can make another contribution this year. What I would like to do tonight is talk about why this theme seems relevant and how I got to it. And also in terms of frames, it's 8:30. I know a lot of people have been traveling, so we're only going to go for about another 4 hours. And then we break for coffee then. This whole thing with denial has been, it's a good time in my life to be looking at this for a couple of reasons. There was a recent death of a very close family member which affected a young child, a 9-year-old child. And living through that for the past 3 years, and the death had just happened about 2 months ago. Also, looking at my hair every morning, my hair getting thinner, my hearing going. I used to do bicycle racing, I played basketball, and I still play ball. I can't do the things I used to. And then I have the memories in my body. And when I play ball, I remember what my legs felt like when I was 17, 18 years old. And I mean, these are small things on one hand, but what it does, it begins to make you realize a sense of mortality. And it's sort of interesting that what I'm reading again is the story of Dorian Gray, which is all about this pact with the devil around immortality. The other reason I find this so relevant is that I just realized I've been practicing for 25 years as a therapist and as a psychoanalyst. And I find that psychopathology, really, the whole notion of psychopathology doesn't help us anymore. And I've taught psychopathology on a graduate level and doctoral programs, master's degree programs. I taught in psychoanalytic institutes. And I feel as I'm a very good diagnostician. But I find now it doesn't get us anywhere when you look at what's wrong with things. When you find how people, oh, that's perverted, that's really sick, that's dysfunctional. And the way I got to that, and I hope during the course of maybe tomorrow's talk to go over what I've found with the past 2 years of my work, because this idea of patterns and innate ordering processes has really developed a lot. And one big piece is this notion of pathology. And sort of a long story short, I realized that when you're looking at things that are sick and pathological, you're really looking at a normative model. And you're saying if something doesn't meet the norm, you're dealing with deviancy. Now look, I've been dealing with patterns, looking at patterns for many years now. Dealing with Jung's notion of the psyche and archetypes. And he says, you know, these archetypes are very strange to the conscious mind. Going back to reading Hillman, and if you haven't read Hillman's book, The Soul's Code, or haven't read it in a while, oh, it's a brilliant piece of work. Go back to it. Do you have any books here, Bobby? The Soul's Code? Okay. Well, put your hold on it. It's a great book. And the point he makes all the way through, which matches so much where I'm going to with his work on patterning and archetypal expression, is that pathology really doesn't exist in the world. What you have are archetypal expressions. And the way I got to this was, and again, it's a long series of sort of steps to get here, but when you look at a pattern, you begin to realize that anything that is configured in the natural world and the human psyche, anything that has shape or form or design, does so because there's something driving it. In other words, and I'll give the term and then I'll try to translate. Anything that is configured does so because there's a stable morphology underneath it. In other words, there's a stable code, there's a stable body of information, there's a stable archetypal field out of which things begin to emerge. And Jung was one of the first to say this. He said, you know, when we look at dreams, we say the dreams are disguised. You know, the dreams are trying to hide, obscure things. And that's really the whole Freudian method of dream interpretation. Trying to find out what's underneath the dream, what is being hidden in the material. And Jung said, you know, nature doesn't hide anything. Nature reveals. If you understand that, he says, well, if we don't understand what a dream means or what a symptom means or what a behavior means or what a particular fantasy means, it's because we don't understand the particular language or dialects of the psyche. So if that's the case, how do we begin to understand this language? And I could tell you, this has been one of the most important breakthroughs in my work in the past probably 15 years. And again, I have a very strong judgmental side. I could judge very quickly. And I think I may have told this story last time I was here. One of the ways I got to this piece on no pathology was I was lecturing up in Calgary, up in Alberta, in dead of winter. And it was late night. It was a long, like, 14-hour flight. It was nutty. And I just went to my room afterwards, and I do research late at night. I watch Jerry Springer. And I will admit it, I watch Jerry Springer. Well, this night, and some of you may remember this tale, he had on men that like to be babies and the women who love them. And I thought, well, this is going to be a hell of a show. And what they had was this one guy came out, around a 38-year-old guy in a diaper and a rattle and in the baby outfit, and actually built a big crib on the stage. And I thought, if my father could only see this. My father's 84, still going strong. And he's playing baby games. And they talk to him, and he said, well, what do you do with your time? He said, well, I sit around all day, and I draw, and I doodle, and I think, man, he's got a lot of time on his hands. And then they brought out his wife. And I said, Mama, I never saw anything like this in my life. The most tragic, pathetic figure I think I've ever seen. And I'm ready to say, you know, what a sick world we live in. And I realized, wait a minute, you know, they found each other. These people, they're happy together. You know what? God bless them. They have a life, they have birthday parties, and apparently they have a big website for people who want to be babies, and they invite each other for birthday parties and rattle parties and wet balloon parties and all this. And I tell you, it's sort of a crazy story, but it was helpful to me. And then I realized that what we call dysfunction is really, and what we call dysfunction and pathology is really about a drama that we just fail to understand. And again, every drama is the expression. Every pattern you see is an expression of some archetype who finds a way to express itself in ways that are consistent with the core of that archetypal structure. Now, Jung went back and forth about archetypes. Sometimes he said, well, the archetype is fully fleshed out by the individual experience. Other times he said the archetype is a priori, autonomous. Other times we can never know archetypes at all. Other times he was a brilliant man, and brilliant people struggle with definitions and they never want to be pinned down. And Jung always said, look, if you want to pin this down, it's like taking a butterfly, pinning it up to a board. You don't want to do it. Psyche is mercurial. However, in the work I've been doing, I would say that archetypal alignments are much more stable than we ever wanted to realize, in that their mode of expression seems to be consistent. Their mode of expression has high degrees of regularity in it, in terms of how it expresses itself today, 100 years ago, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. There's some stable core. And with that, when you begin to understand it, I mean, no matter how bizarre the drama looks to you, and again, this has been a stretch for me to do this, whether it's cases... And let me say one word about casework. I know we had some discussion last time I was here. Any case I ever present in public is a composite of many, many different cases I've read about, cases I've heard in supervision. It will never be a case I'm working on. So just to have that as part of our groundwork, okay? I mean, let's say you hear a story about somebody that's burning themselves, or somebody who's actively cutting themselves, or somebody that is actively taking hot things and just putting it on their arms. You say, my God, it must be your mother, the inner mother who hated you, or the father that terrorized you through sexual behavior, through tyrannical behavior, and that's what you're expressing. It's all so simple with these kind of interpretations. And look, I could do this with the best of them. It's the inner this, the inner persecutory that, it's the inner object, it's the negative mother, the positive. Let's change the paradigm. And a nice way to change is by drawing on something that Deschardin said. And I gave this quote in Italy last year that Richard and Sylvia came to. And he says, matter is spirit moving slowly enough to be seen. And I thought, man, this is so beautiful. Matter is spirit moving slowly enough to be seen. What that means, what I think he's saying with that is, very much in the spirit of St. Francis. It really is a Franciscan approach to life, if you think about it, too. It's a natural approach to life, in that whatever gets expressed is the expression of something. Something working to express itself. Something working to show its face. It's not trying to disguise anything. So matter moving slowly enough to be seen. So if that's the case, why don't we take the time to look? When you judge, you've already got it understood, and then you got it locked away somewhere, and you got a whole treatment methodology worked out. Corrective emotional experience, we do some good interpretive work, we offer a good solid frame, and hopefully in time there's going to be a change in the person. And hopefully they could stop these crazy things like burning their arms with irons and pots and branding irons. Or these crazy things, you know, called new tribalism. People are putting hooks all through their bodies, mutilating their bodies, and hooks in their chest, hooks in their penis. But you say, what a crazy world. Shift it again. And the paradigm is one of shifting from pathology to expression. Expression again means that we're looking at the various ways the psyche goes about manifesting itself to express something particular. Okay. Now enter the work of David Bohm, the Nobel Prize winning physicist. Towards the end of his life, he also became fascinated with experience and phenomena. And he said, well, science for many years has tried to pin things down too. With the whole Newtonian model, we can understand what happens, we can understand and chart trajectories, and it's all very well known. As long as you can understand a few initial conditions, you can make some great calculations. And we know this works. I mean, there are at least one or two physicists in the room, and you know Newtonian physics works. How else could you send satellites or people to the moon if you couldn't do these calculations? Bohm, Einstein, and all the great minds, they said, but you know, there's something else there, and what they called hidden variables. There's something else influencing how things work, and you can never pin it down. Einstein called it the ether. He said, maybe it's the ether. That's why we create these hidden variables. And Bohm said, well, it's things we will never know about. And really, it's a way to sort of knock our own hubris, whether in science, in psychology, in social work, in religion, okay? So he developed what he called the ontological approach, which is really a fantastic way of working and living your life. And again, you know, if any psychology works, it's because it's talking about life in a meaningful way. The ontological approach really deals with experience. And what it does is it tries to strip the observer from any preconceived biases. So you're able to try to look at the phenomena as it is. Let's say somebody's actively involved in burning their arms. Okay, and those of you that are clinicians in the room, you have probably seen this or have read about or heard about cases where people actively burn themselves and they scar and they brand themselves. Something I'm really trying to teach myself with this, and it's a very tough discipline, is to just say what it is. And one of the ways I go about this, and a lot of this is drawn from Bohm's work, is to say it's striking to me that there's so much energy that goes into burning your arms. Whoa. That means you're gonna say this is good. This means that it's something very purposeful in it. It means it. How are you helping anybody? How are you helping them deal with the inner hatred? Say, I don't know what's hatred. I don't know what it is. And this is not false humility, okay? That's not one of my problems. When you strip it of all the biases and interpretations and theories that we have, and again, I think you need to know your theory. Be a really good clinician, be a good theoretician, and you know. However, but if you say, okay, what do we have in front of us now? Somebody who's burning themselves. Then you ask the question, which really it takes us right back to the heart of Jung. He said, do we know anything about this experience? What do you mean? Have we ever seen it before? Have you ever seen any experience where people do burn themselves? And they do this sort of branding on their arms. And there was a particular case that we were working on. A few of us were supervising this case. And what came to mind was, remember the whole TV show Kung Fu? David Carradine. Remember David Carradine? And the way the show would begin, they would do sort of a recasting of his whole life up to the point to where he was today, from being a little grasshopper and all this. But remember one of the major scenes. After he finished the bulk of his traditional training, they said, now you have a test. The rite of initiation and the rite of real passage to be fully admitted into his religious group. And what they did? They took a hot burning anvil and they put it on his arms. And the anvil had the insignia of the particular, what would you call it, discipline, religious group he was part of. And they burned it into his arms. Well, what does it mean? You know? How come suddenly a patient is doing an activity that we have had since the beginning of time? So this is very much of a shift for me in my work. Now, what do you do with it? Now, I can't answer this right now, and this because this is so much of a work in progress, but what it does, it totally offers validation to Jung's approach of the objective psyche, that the objective psyche works by taking hold of individuals and creating these kind of possessions and getting them involved in behaviors that they do not understand. And I'm telling you that as clinicians, I think we've been barking down the wrong tree for a long time by trying to understand it as some version of sickness or inner pathology. With this method of observation, and realizing, okay, man, look, I've been doing this work 25 years. Where am I with this? What am I seeing as a clinician? And I tell you, I love my work as an analyst. I really enjoy what I do. And I've begun to do more consulting, going to corporations and listening to their stories and trying to understand what's going on as organizational, sort of an archetypal consultant. And I found that no matter how I enter a system, whether an individual or an organization, I find two things at work. Across the board. One is, life is not about pathology and sickness, it's about destiny. This is another theme. Sometimes get a really good speaker on destiny. Because destiny has to do with the unfolding of something that is alive in your life from the beginning, which will go about, again, staying with this word, expressing itself in every facet of your life until you get it. And if you look back over your life, you think about some of those things from childhood on that you'll never, ever forget. That one time fishing with your mother or father or playing ball, or that one time going to the store. And I don't know why, I can't ever forget that one visit to my grandmother's house. And then you begin to see that there's a certain clustering that goes on in your life where a number, maybe three or four or five events from age 5 to age 20 to age 40 to age 60, something has stood like a contiguous line, like a thread throughout your life. And it holds you. Plato talked about this in detail, about the destiny factor. And he gave this beautiful example. He said, it's as though the daimon, the destiny, the creativity, the creative soul of one's individual, it comes to you at birth. Fully understandable, fully articulated. And I don't have the quotes, it's not important now, but he said it comes down to you really clear and you could see it, you can almost read it, and then all of a sudden as it gets closer to you, the words become unintelligible. I remember 17, 18 years ago, a patient had a dream in which a piece of paper was coming down from the sky with the fate on it, with his fate or destiny. As it got closer and closer to him, the words all disappeared. You talk about archetypal dreams. And you see, again, that this destiny force will draw to it things as means of actualizing this innate pattern, this innate archetypal configuration as alive for the individual. I mean, I see with my son, you're going to meet my son, he's here this week, and he's a real trip, Christopher. And he's got this thing with art. No matter where he goes, he has to do art. Even if you give him a piece of clay, he does three-dimensional clay building. It's a gift, what he has. You spill some salt on a table, all of a sudden you find his fingers making something out of it. It's as though he has to do it. And I look back, okay, look, I know there's a number of people much older than me in this group, 84 years old or whatever, 70s. But I look at my life now and I say, what's important? I mean, obviously family, career and all that. But I'll tell you right now, and I'll put myself on the line with this. If I don't do what I'm supposed to do every day, or at least every other day, you don't want to be near me. I know from whatever reason I need to read, in addition to all my other things, I do, my family life and all, and parenting, and my career. If I don't get a chance to read or write, I'm miserable. It's like a food you have to eat. And if you don't, I mean, you know what it's like. Any of you have kind of sugar problems, or you skip a meal, whatever, and you suddenly find you have too much wine the night before, or whatever, and you suddenly find you're a little off kilter, like the engine's not running right. And you say, what is this thing? What is it that's not being fed? It's the destiny piece. And I've begun to see this all through my work with patients, that the central issue is, can you look at somebody and try to understand what is this thing that is shaped in them and is trying to shape their experience? And I think it's a very tough, but I think one of the most meaningful things you could do, any kind of therapy, to try to get a sense of these innate ordering processes. The next piece I found as a clinician is that, also as an individual, as a friend and as a family member, running neck and neck with destiny is denial. And denial very simply is the attempts to obliterate meaning and experiences. The attempt to kick out of your life things that don't fit, things that you don't want to look at. And I could tell you, throughout these 4 days, many experiences and stories where you see, and you mentioned the word brutal in my book. Why it's brutal, in my opinion? It's brutal because denial holds everyone captive that is in there, in the field of the person that's in denial. It'll kick everyone out that doesn't resonate with it, and it'll make you obey the tenets of that process. It also, the other thing that dawned on me about 2 months ago, thinking about this denial piece, is that denial is archetypal. That's number one. And that's why when you read about concentration camp experiences, you read about trauma experiences, it's inevitable some denial comes up, whether it's Viktor Frankl's work in logotherapy. Ernest Becker, fortunately I get the book at the bookstore. A must read, in my opinion, is Ernest Becker's The Denial of Death. It is brilliant. Okay? That you begin to see that overwhelming life situations seem to evoke denial. A plane going down, cancer, heart attacks, fathers coming into little girls' bedrooms, alcoholic background. It's inevitable there's going to be a denial as a response. And that's when it dawned on me that denial is archetypal. It's, in other words, it's hardwired into the psyche. It's an innate process in the psyche, which may be one of the ways nature helps us deal with these things, like a circuit breaker. Well, if it's natural, how could it be brutal? The effects are still brutal on people. And I've seen denial work in ways that it decimates families. We're in a situation in our culture, we talked about shadow, huh? In our culture today, where we are involved in a major piece of denial. This is a funny story you mentioned about the veterans in this group. You know, another. I was just giving a major lecture a couple weeks ago on school violence, patterns of violence. Now, I'm no expert in school violence, and I said that up front. I said I want to talk about patterns and how what the psyche may be working over. And one woman got up who was one of the major social workers in the tri-state area. She said, look, the reason there's violence is because there's violence on TV. She had things like Space Ranger TV shows for kids or wrestling and all this. She said, that's why there's violence. Shut the TV off and you're going to get rid of the violence. I said, well, just as a hypothesis, and I try to practice being really scientific at times. I said, as a hypothesis, it doesn't work, because if that was the case, everybody that watches this would be violent. Right? So if, huh? Oh, it's right. I said, do you see how much denial you're living with, having this idea? So what are you trying to say? I said, well, look, I'm with you about how much violence we see on TV and everything. And I gave a story about wrestling. I don't know if you ever watch wrestling. I don't. I just, you know, do the surfing sometimes. It has gone bizarre that the men are beating up women in wrestling rings today, and then millions of people are clapping and spending millions of dollars. I said, where the hell are we going with this stuff? But the point I was getting at where denial comes in here is that if things like wrestling and men beating up women with chairs and bats is making millions of dollars, if we have things like extreme football coming back, basketball, sports have become so violent today. If you have all these cartoon shows for kids, those of you that are grandparents or parents, watch the shows. It's pretty wicked stuff. So the Space Rangers, something, I forget the name of it now. Power Rangers, thank you, Power Rangers. And even the Pokemon cartoons and all this stuff. The people, they shoot each other with lasers, they're killing, cutting off arms and legs. I said, you know, I think the issue is that we have had war and violence since the beginning of time. You know. What you have is there's something in the psyche that is resonating with these expressions of violence in the outer world today. as a way to find a means to express something that is innate. When it's concretized, it goes haywire and is all hell to pay. And we know these things are atrocious, what's going on with school violence. Right? But again, it's issues of denial. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to put more cops in the classroom, more cops at the gate, and we're going to have metal detectors. We're going to deal with it that way. Ding. We're going to take the violent shows off TV. Excuse me, you're back with denial. How do you break denial? One of the ways is facing the truth. Part of the truth is that violence, aggression, competition, territoriality has been with us since the beginning of time. Now, religion. Well, religion is all about love and helping people and all about getting to heaven. Hey, how many years have we had the religious crusades? How many hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in the name of religion? I'm not saying anything innate about religion. I'm trying to make a point, which is when you crack these denial structures and you see where it's so costly. For instance, let's say you're working in the school system. I mean, any school counselors here or whatever? This will be relevant to you. You got kids involved in violence. You begin to have a pattern of violence in the kids. Little Joey's throwing rocks and hitting kids in the schoolyard. And then afterwards he goes to the baseball game and he's pinning some of the kids against the dugout wall. Well, he's had a bad day or a bad week. Whose denial is it? You see, and this is where patterning comes in. When you begin to look at a piece of behavior, and I think a nice way to frame it is, any singular piece of behavior can be taken as a freeze frame moment. And I gave the last time I was here, we talked more about holography, that it's a holographic encapsulation of a pattern. Any moment is a holographic encapsulation of the feel that one is embedded in. Take it seriously. What is it? Now, here's sort of the punchline to a lot of this. What is it that obliterates our capacity to read patterns? Every living organism survives by virtues of pattern recognition. What does that pattern recognition mean? It means being able to read the environment, being able to read the conditions for safety. It's a reptilian brain, okay? They say the most elementary and the most basic and primitive of the brain function. It's a reptilian brain that can read. Is it safe to come out or not? The littlest fish know. If I come out, if there's too many come out, then maybe the bigger fish come to get me, okay? Or the deer right now. In Vermont, you know, we're hitting springtime like you are here, maybe about a couple weeks behind you. All of the winter coats are coming off. Okay, its capacity to be in tune with nature and to read it. When fall comes, late fall, what happens? Inevitably, the animals begin their rites of, what do you call, harvesting, where they gather the nuts and they gather the berries and they get the nest. You know, all the, you get the point. The point is, every creature survives. Every organism that's alive does so because they can read a pattern. So I got that. And I said then, okay. And I spent a lot of years articulating patterns, and we talked about it here a lot 2 years ago. Patterns, what stabilizes patterns? And one of the things that stabilizes patterns is replication. Okay, I'm not going to go over old ground that much, but the point is, we have patterns that are stabilized that are understandable and recognizable. Okay? You have two dates with somebody. It's for the younger people in the audience. You go out for a couple of dates, or your grandchildren are going out dating, and you see a pattern right away. How come your grandkids can't see it? Well, they only got drunk a couple of times. They only pushed me a little bit. They only neglected my kid 4 of the 6 hours. And then I'm asking myself, well, what the hell is this? Every door I went to had the same sign on it as a plausible answer for this. It's denial. That there's something in the human psyche that, as strong as the need to make meaning, is the need to obliterate meaning. And I could tell you it's probably the most costly thing we have in our culture and our human life today. And as an analyst, I tell you it's the thing that is the most, I don't want to say unbearable, it's too dramatic. It's one of the most frustrating things I've ever had to deal with. With individuals, whether in therapy or family members or friends, what the denial process begins to do is it takes a relationship and starts to shape it around the terrain of that denial. And you begin to know, well, something's off. Something's not being dealt with. Now, where I've gone with this, and one of the skills I'm really working on, is that by the particular configuration of the denial process, see where I'm going? You can tell what's being denied. Anna Freud said this back when, and I don't remember what year she wrote the book, Ego and the Mechanisms of Defense, when she said if the particular defenses that are used often reveal the nature of what's being defended against. Okay? In other words, the way we habitually go about our life and the way we habitually strive not to look at something, often with, hey, what it is you're not looking at. Okay, there's a piece of my book I quote of a famous poet who says, I carry this stick every day so I remember what I want to forget. But that's what this is about. And then I begin to see, like when I supervise people, I do a lot of clinical supervision, a lot of supervising consultants now, and really good people, they're doing great work. All of a sudden, something comes up and there's a block. And they stop doing the significant work. Patients, they begin treatment. Significant treatment starts. Something happens. You say, well, I think I had enough. I think I want to do more of this kind of therapy or that kind of therapy. Well, what is it? It's when you begin to hit the repressed and what is being denied. Now, this is a very difficult issue. I hope it's clear. I'm not talking about therapy. I'm talking about life, using the therapeutic relationship as a way to understand some of this. And if the language is not clear, I want to leave a lot of room for dialogue in this, okay? I want to present my ideas, and my frame is to speak for about an hour each of these sessions, an hour or so, and then open up to some discussion, for a lot of discussion, because I know it's a very hot issue. So what happens then is in treatment, one begins coming into therapy, and the way the therapy is configured, basically is configured along the lines of two things. Whatever this destiny factor is, and the other part is along these lines of denial. Now, people often say, well, you need a lot of time to establish a therapeutic alliance with somebody. In other words, you need to have a good rapport with somebody before you can begin addressing what's being denied. Okay. Maybe it takes a couple of months, maybe 6 months, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, maybe you never get to it. Because the patient's not ready. Well, you know, one of the people that blew the lid on this whole issue is Robert Langs. I don't know if you know his work. He said, you know, we talk about the patient all the time. So look at the therapist. And he wrote an incredible article. It's called Patients and Therapists' Fear of the Secure Frame. Secure frame is when you have really secure conditions of therapy, where you know your therapist is doing meaningful work, they're not acting out and all this stuff. And it brings up the highest levels of dread for the therapist as well. And I can tell you, after all these years of practicing, it's so true in that when you make a really good interpretation, when you are really present in a profound way, two things happen. On one hand, you're going to get stories of, oh, I moved into this beautiful home. I had this wonderful neighborhood. I got the most beautiful neighbors. When I was sick one day, they came and cut my lawn. Or I have this new, I'm taking a class, this wonderful teacher. Okay, you get all the stories. Yeah, I guess I was on target. I got it. Then he said, you know that teacher I told you about I really like? I found out they have cancer. They're dying. Did I tell you my father's going blind? See, what has happened? How come I'm getting on one hand all these beautiful stories about success and finding meaning and somebody that could empathize with them? And then I get the next series of stories around death. And I think Langs hit it right on the head when he said, the moments of greatest love bring up the greatest levels of despair. And I think it is so true across the life experience. And I think I may have also mentioned the story when I was here 2 years ago, that when my son was really young, we would take a shower. I would hold him in my arms, you know. And I think, I can't do it because he's going to fall. Or when I would watch him, you know, in the bassinet next to me. You watch him, and you have these fears. Oh my God, he could die with sudden infant, what is SIDS and all this stuff, sudden infant death, or a heart's going to stop, whatever. And then I called a good friend of mine, a lovely, very wise old woman from India, who's also a Jungian analyst. I said, am I sick? I said, am I really having like some crazy death wish? She said, Michael, it's love. When you love somebody that much, you have to face the fact you could lose them. Oh, that's pretty morbid. I think it's real. I think morbidity is when you languish in that emotion. That's all you feel. Oh, it's just about misery. Like one sit shiver for the rest of their life. That's misery. That's neurotic suffering. And Jung said, you know, neurotic suffering is when you don't deal with meaning. Legitimate suffering is when you try to understand that life is a process. You know? And I find again, whether it's in therapy, whether it's in a love relationship, I mean, if you find somebody you got companionship with, you better thank God. If you get on your knees and thank God, if you got somebody you can talk to. Somebody you can... Have you ever had a meltdown? You know, meltdown? When you feel like you got nothing left? You got no resources left? Just a moment. Maybe once every couple of years. And you just cry with somebody. You say, I can't do it no more. That's love. And you feel dread because that person, you know what they could do? They could turn around and stick a knife in your back. Oh, that's great. Because, Michael, you're a Sicilian. There's the only reason you think this way. They stick a knife in your back. Well, of course, you get the Neapolitan background. You know? It's not. It's real. If you're honest with yourself and you really process what is honestly going on in your psyche, when you feel that kind of contentment, you know why? You know why one of the reasons? We talk about we have no time anymore. Right? Everyone's running nuts. Well, one thing the scientists have found is that the electromagnetic field has actually sped up. Number one. So time is going differently. However, you can't hit a moving target. It's like, let's say there is kind of depression or death anxiety. You know, yeah. And you think about it too. If you're always running and you're always doing things and you're always busy and you're doing programming and you get this, you don't have a chance to sit. You finally sit down, what happens to you? A couple of things happen to you. One is you feel, you know what? I love this room. Hopefully everybody has a room in their house that they love. Like I happen to love oriental rugs. And I have these rugs I really care about in my house and the room kind of structured around it. And you sit there and you feel, my God, all is well in the world right now. The next wave that comes to you is what? Come on, Michael. This is just your psychology. Just the patients you work with. I think these are universals. And again, I've been around long enough. I'm not as old as some of you in here, but I've been working in this field for quite a while now, and I see it's inevitable. The minute you have a moment of security, you're going to have a level of dread that comes to you, which is not about morbidity, it's not about sickness, it's not about neurosis, it's about natural processes. And when somebody feels that, you know what I'll say to them as a patient? I say, thank God you're there. Now you know what it's like to be cared about. Now you know what it's like to have real vulnerability. I got to feel this and I don't want it. I don't want to be vulnerable. I don't want to feel anything then.